Okay, let's get started, folks. Good morning. Welcome to the third day of Tech at Barcelona. How's everyone doing this morning? All right, let me ask a different question. How many of you have went to bed before midnight last night? Well, you know, I knew it. This is Barcelona, right? So people don't go to lunch until 2 p.m., no dinner until 10 p.m., so no one go to sleep before midnight. You know, jokes aside, I do realize that many of you come from Europe, of course, but also people come from Asia, some people from North America or South America. You know, having to wake up at 6 a.m., coming to this session at 8:30. As crazy as it may sound, I realize there's also 12 sessions at the same time, starting at 8:30. The fact that you're showing up in this session tells me nothing but your interest, your investment, and your trust into VMM as the product for your either virtualization environment or your private cloud environment. So we sincerely, on behalf of about 100 engineers in VMM product team, thank you for coming over here. As Jonabi, Srikant has been passing the surveys to you, we really wanted to hear from you as to what things that we should do better, what things you like about the product, what things that you don't like about the product. This is your opportunity to make sure that your voice, your feedback, your ideas are heard by the product team. As a matter of fact, we're going to use the data, feedback to the engineering team. We'll use that to prioritize what we need to invest next. So please spend a couple minutes either during the session, after the session, or before if you've done that. Thank you very much, but please do fill that out. In addition, as you can see on this slide, I also have a link to a quick survey for CPS. If you have not seen or heard of CPS, don't worry, I'll be talking about that in the later part of the session. We'll also be asking about some questions. If you could note it down, it's really easy to remember, surveymonkey.com/S/TEE CPS. If you could go online and fill that out, that also help us to understand what are your pain points, what are things that we are you know, not solving for you, and what are things that you like about it. So today's session, I would like to structure it in a way that we're going to talk about mainly three things. Of course, the main topic of today is about best practice on deploying and monitor and operating VMM in a private cloud, particularly in a scale-out, large-scale private cloud environment. But before we go to that, I'd like to also talk about, you know, what has changed in VMM 2012 R2 since we released about a year ago. We'll also be touch on what is new or what has been made available in the technical preview, what we call Windows Server and System Center vNext technical preview that was recently made available. At the end, we'll spend probably majority of our time around best practice on CPS, on VMM, under the context of how we build and how we create a CPS solution. We think it's very relevant to large-scale data center environment, so this hopefully will be of value to you as well. Now, before we go into the content of VMM, I'd like to bring us to the all-up Microsoft Cloud Vision, just to make sure. I mean, if you've been to other sessions, this slide probably you've seen a couple of times, but I'd like to make sure just highlight a couple of things. Number one, Microsoft, we believe really we're in a unique position where we can help our enterprise customers to best manage their cloud environment. You may ask why. The two things we think is very strong in Microsoft, number one, is the public cloud experience, right? So think about Windows Azure, think about Office 365, think about Link and Bing. And by the way, does anyone know that even before Amazon, before Google, before VMware, there is a very large scale online service exist in Microsoft for probably 20 years now. Does anyone want to take a guess what that is? What's that? Hotmail. Well, that's one for sure. That's a good one. Windows Update. Windows Update essentially is an online service that existed for 20 years. So we have lots and lots of experience on how to run a large scale online service, how to offer a cloud service back then. And cloud and enterprise grade software, we have been shipping that for years. No matter it's Windows Server, SQL Server, Exchange, Link, SharePoint, all these things we have grown with our enterprise customers. So we understand the enterprise space. We understand your pain point. We also have the experience of what is important for enterprise class customers, no matter you're in business sector, government sector, financial industry, or education industry. So combine those two experience and knowledge, we believe we're in a unique position to power hybrid cloud experience. We all know today, Europe is probably one of the typical example where there's a lot of regulations and rules around privacy, compliance that limits data to not be able to publish or take advantage of the public cloud. So we believe actually going forward in the foreseeable future, there's a large number of customers will need to have the ability to manage in a hybrid cloud environment. Some of the workloads will be able to move to public cloud, while some of the workloads will have to remain staying in the on-prem environment. So the ability to operate a cloud environment that can go across your private data center and the public data center to us is very important. And with combined knowledge between running a hyperscale public cloud service and an enterprise software grade experience, we think we're in a unique position that no one else in the industry today can offer you. No matter it's Amazon, Google, or VMware, they don't have both world. Now let's drill in a little bit around what do we mean by kind of this hybrid cloud experience, and what do we mean by bringing the best of both worlds into your private data center. I like to focus on the consistent cloud OS experience. Again, this slide is not very new, but I like it because I think it illustrates very well about our value props and the value to you. So on the left-hand side of the screen, what you're seeing is a Windows Azure high-level topology. Right on the bottom of it is the blue, big blue box. That's essentially all the fabric resources that are managed by Windows Azure. Think about compute, storage, and network. On top of the big blue box, there's a set of green boxes. They represent the set of services that's offered by Windows Azure. And the interface on top of those green boxes, those are essentially the API layer, the service management API layer that expose those service to either developers or end users. And of course, on top of that, we have the portal experience. If you have been to Windows Azure portal, you'll notice that the new user experience is quite slick. Now, on the right-hand side, so we essentially took our learning and experience and the skill and move that over to the private cloud environment. As a matter of fact, one of the first things we did is we put Windows Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V into Windows Azure. So all the hypervisor layer, at the hypervisor layer, what you have in your data center is identical to what Windows Azure runs as the backend, right, from a compute perspective. Now moving up the stack, we also have a very similar API interface with Windows Azure, right? So you get from Windows Azure Pack the similar API and similar user experience. One thing you know that we added a service admin portal that does not exist in Windows Azure. That because we believe our user in an enterprise and private cloud environment, you need a UI for that. For Microsoft, when you're running Windows Azure, most of the operations are done in a DevOps environment, so that the UI is not necessarily the main thing. Now, after the UI, one thing you'll see is we'll gradually, as we explore and experiment and learn the service that we offer on Windows Azure side, those green boxes, we'll move them gradually over to the private cloud environment as well. Right, so today in Windows Azure Pack, we have IaaS, which is a VM cloud service. We also have website services, SQL and then MySQL services. These are the PaaS services and Service Bus as well. So as we explore and experiment on Windows Azure side, as we mature those services, we'll make them available on the on-prem world as well. If you snap to this architecture in your private data center, you essentially will have a future-proof architecture that allows you to grow with us, with Windows Azure. And this is where you take advantage of the hyperscale cloud experience and technology that has been battleground tested in Windows Azure and other places operated by Microsoft into your own data center. All right, so now let's take a look at what has changed since VMM 2012 R2. You know, again, we released about a year ago. We have so far, up to the day before yesterday, we just released our UR4. So if you have been following that, it's been 4 UR releases. The architecture or how we think about cloud within VMM under the Virtual Machine Manager context has not changed. So the foundation of that is we start from managing those fabric resources. Again, compute, storage, and network. And what do we mean by compute resources? These are the Windows Server hosts. They can be either pre-installed by you with Windows Server Hyper-V host. They can also be bare metal computers as long as they have BMC or service processor that supports IPMI. We will be able to manage them and provision them into Hyper-V host and clusters. On the storage side, what we mean by that is essentially most of the existing storage solution, no matter it's iSCSI or Fibre Channel SAN, NAS devices, or just JBOD, then we can actually provision a Windows Server on top of them and manage them through either SMB's 3-share or direct block storage. On the networking side, the network resources we manage includes IP address space, no matter it's a fixed IP, DHCP, subnet ranges, VLAN ranges, and in addition to that, we also manage network switches and load balancers. Right, so you can add those devices into VMM in the sense that we work with our partner that comes with the provider model, and we talk through the provider to the device to make changes as part of the VM provisioning, workload provisioning. So once those resources are added to VMM, and we create resource pools around those physical resources, and then once those pools are created, then we can expose those resources in the form of a cloud in VMM. And then those cloud you could be able to offer those cloud as a service to a set of self-service user, right? And then you can define capacity, quota. In addition, you can also define a set of standardized templates to offer to your user as a way to provision a set of predefined workloads. Obviously, at the very top is that you can also use a self-service self-service portal experience to allow your user to come in and do self-service. So these are not new. Now let's again look at what has changed in R2. There are 3 buckets of things I'd like to talk about. The first one is that we have resolved, again, by UR2, more than 200 customer issues. On one hand, there's a lot of issues that we've resolved. On the other hand, you should also look at it in the sense that we have added a lot of value since we released RTM. All those issues, the credit should really go back to customer, you, in the audience today. Because of you, report the issue through our support organization to us, and we are able to fix those issues, address them, and then return the benefit back to all the other customers. A kudo to all of you down there. Now, please know that those issues are not necessarily just, software bugs. Some of them are actually considered as changing product behavior based on the deeper understanding now with our customer's environment. And I'll give you some examples in the next slide and talk about what has been changed. And obviously, I won't be able to talk about everything, but I'll give you some examples on what has changed so that you have a taste of that. The second bucket thing I want to mention is that we have now enabled a faster cadence. What I mean by that is, up to VMM 2012 R2 UR4, we have not been able to introduce new feature in the product in a UR. By the way, UR is the update rollups. In a sense, there are certain product limitation, engineering system limitation, and some policy limitation as well that we cannot release new capabilities, new features. But after UR4, we have made enough change in the product, so we will be able to release new capabilities post UR4. And this is also why that we ask you to fill out the survey today so that we can better prioritize our engineering resources to see what new capability we need to deliver. We believe this is a very, very important capabilities for us to invest, to enable us to do, because this will allow us to respond faster to customer demands, to market condition, to some of the changing trend in the industry. Lastly, but not leastly, building a better diagnosability. I'm not sure how many of you had this frustrating experience when working with our support organization. You run into a failure, you call the support, you say, I have a failure. What do they tell you to do first thing? Do you have a log or do you have a trace? If you don't, then they will ask you to repro. Now, you go back and you try to repro it and capture the trace, you send it to support, and guess what? They're gonna ask you to do some additional repro by turning on some additional logging. Right? This thing typically goes back and forth several iterations before we can actually nail the root cause. You don't like it, we don't like it. It also costs us a lot more on the support organization. So we are investing in our system, again, in the product itself, to be able to make this a better experience in the sense that we should be able to nail or make the system to capture in real time of what is going wrong, some of the faults in the system that we can dynamically capture them so that we can quickly nail down a failure instead of asking you to go back and forth multiple times. You know, obviously, we probably won't get there in one shot, but we're making investment in that direction to make your experience and our engineering, effort a more efficient one. So, some highlights on the fix that I was promising you on the last slide. Number one, DCP extension updates. I don't know if all of you are aware that we actually, VMM, provision a DHCP extension on all the Hyper-V hosts. This is how we manage the Hyper-V virtualization, network virtualization through this. This is one of the core components in that, in the HNV feature, that all the tenant VMs, if it's DHCP, it needs to get DHCP leads from this extension on each and every one of them. Each one of the hosts. Now, we have discovered since we're releasing R2, some customer experience delay, long delay for those VM to get an IP address from the DHCP extension due to some bugs on our side as well as on Windows client side. So we have worked with the Windows team and resolved that in the latest UR. So if you have seen delays in your VM getting IP addresses, this is probably a good sign that you should get the latest UR. The second one is we added Linux OS different release versions. As Satya and Scott said in one of the most recent announcements, we love Linux. So we added support for all the latest Linux distros, like Oracle Linux 7, Red Hat Enterprise Linux 7, CentOS 7, Ubuntu 12, so all these 14, I'm sorry, not 12. We have all these latest Linux distros supported now. A majority of them are fairly popular ones. Maintenance mode behavior. This is actually a change in product behavior. When we initially designed maintenance mode, we had assumed that when people apply patch to the host, it's typically during a maintenance window. And again, our initial understanding a few years back was during maintenance window, it's acceptable to have downtime of your VMs or the host. Such that when we designed the feature, we kind of assumed that when you put a host in maintenance mode, all the VMs running on the host, it's okay for those VMs to be not operable. Apparently, that's a false assumption, now we learned. Before UR4, UR3, before UR4, the behavior is if you put a node in maintenance mode, if the maintenance mode operation is not complete, you can't really make any changes or take any operation on the VMs. We essentially put locks on all the VMs on that specific host until maintenance mode is finished or until the VMs have been moved to other nodes. So since we heard the feedback, now we have made changes to our system. Now we're aggressively separating or minimize the number of objects we have to walk so that when we can separate the whole side of operation from the get side of operation. So when we are putting a host in maintenance mode, we're not going to put a lock on all the VMs. You can still make changes to those VMs as we're making putting the host into maintenance mode. So so this is, you know, again, one of the feedback that we get from customer, and we're making changes to the product. On the lock contention, again, I don't know how many of you experienced or seen an error message in the job history where it says, job locked job or a locked objects. So it's one of those mysterious error messages that really frustrates people. So what essentially happening is the way how we design the system at the SQL layer as well as our job infrastructure layer, we have been very conservative in a sense as soon as you touch one part of the system, we try to be protective, overly protective, and locking down a set of objects related to that one. Hence, that caused a larger set of kind of ramification. As we grow our internal test environment, as our customers start deploying to a larger environment, we have seen there's a need of loosening up the system a little bit. In the sense we should minimize the number of things we should lock. So we have to change actually fairly deep down on the SQL database schema, as well as our job execution infrastructure to allow minimize the number of objects we have to lock when we make a change to one set of the systems, such that you'll see less number of locked job type of errors going forward. So that's, again, a very significant change. Making system more resilient to out-of-band changes, this started off in 2012 when we start to move from a polling-based update system or polling-based architecture to a event-based kind of architecture. I don't know how long have you used our product, but if you remember probably back in 2008 or 2008 R2, where we have a whole bunch of refreshers running on the background. Some of them run every 2 minutes, some around every 60 minutes, some around every 12 minutes. There's a whole set of refreshers running. And the reason we moved away from that is because as we expand the system, as we trying to increase the scale that VMM can manage, we quickly realized that polling from every single managed object is a very expensive thing to do, right? And plus, in any good distributed system design, you quickly realize that really the best way to get update is change-driven kind of update model, where you don't need to poll the system, you only need to get notified when the change happened in the system. And if you're familiar with the software design principle, in a truly distributed system, probably there's no way for any central management node to get an update from all the nodes at all the time. So what we have changed is we start registering, we start subscribing changes, events-based changes from Hyper-V, from cluster, from clustering service. Now, after changing to that model, one of the things we noticed is that there are actually three different failures would happen that cause the system to go wrong. Starting from the very bottom, that if Hyper-V service or clustering service fail to send out the event, then there's no way for VMM to understand, to see that there's something changing in the system that we need to reflect on the VMM side. The second thing is, the event sent out by Hyper-V or by clustering service could get lost. Because of network glitches or something else, right? And when that happens, again, VMM did not receive the notification. Of course, VMM is not going to make any change on the VMM side. The third thing is there could be fault or faulty logic in VMM's event parsing logic or the correlation processing logic. So when we receive a storm of events coming in from various hosts that we manage, they're possibly wrong logic in our code that actually processing those events in an improper way or incorrect way so that we missed certain changes. And after we received a few customer feedbacks, we actually re-looked at how the correlation logic works inside of VMM. We also added some resiliency in case certain event got lost, right? So we also add resiliency to the system so that to make our detection of out-of-band changes more robust. You know, are we completely 100% there yet? Probably not. But I'm confident that after the set of changes that we made, the out-of-band change will be more will be promptly reflected in VMM console. The team NIC, this is another interesting thing that we have when we initially designed our team NIC management in VMM, we had always assumed that all the NICs that you put in one NIC will always be available. If any NIC goes into a disabled state, we think something is wrong with the system. But apparently, we quickly learned that many customers are actually creating a NIC, a teamed NIC, and then they go back to the teamed NIC, they disable one or more in the teamed NIC just to test whether or not the team NIC works. Apparently, this is a common practice, but when you actually do that, before we release the UR, it'll actually crash the VMM service. So we quickly developed the fix, and so now from this point onwards, you should be able to disable team NIC, one of the physical NIC, and VMM service should be keep going. Obviously, the last two was really kind of learning as we expand our international coverage, as more and more international customers are adopting VMM technology, they discover some non-English language limitations in the product. We're very happy to discover those issues with customer and address them in a timely manner. So again, there are probably 200 plus fixes out there in all those URs we released. And my recommendation or sincere suggestion to you is please always install the latest UR. They're just bags of goodies in my mind. Halloween is coming in the US. I just imagine them as bags of candies that every time we release one of those things, go ahead and take them. The best part is free of charge. And in addition, that as we move forward to UR5, remember we'll also be able to release new capabilities, so they become even more interesting for you to adopt. I know there's a question in the back. If you don't mind, could you hold on to a question to the very end? A lot of content cover. Thank you. So the vNext, Windows Server vNext, System Center vNext, we are releasing a technical preview. I want to cover what is in the technical preview. I want to make sure that we are on the same page on that. So technical preview is a way for us to let you get an early access to some of the early thinkings on our future direction. Technical preview is not supported for production, right? And you feel free to try it out in your labs or in a sandbox environment, but please we don't recommend you putting to your production. As a result of that, the set of functionalities we suggest you to test will be a subset of the capability you see in VMM 2012 R2, for example. Also as kind of advertisements, please do read the release note. In the release note, we clearly call out what scenarios that we recommend you to try. Anything that's not on the list, we do not recommend you to try. All right, so let's take a look at the compute set of capabilities and the OS support matrix. Obviously, the technical preview is the main purpose to allow you to try out Windows Server technical preview. So that's the key support. And VMM and the library server also needs to be on the same OS version. And Hyper-V host is also only limited to vNext, the technical preview. The thing that I want to point out is also the database. We support SQL Server 2014, not SQL Server 2012. going forward, you probably see that we'll add the SQL Server 2014 into our support matrix. Lots of customers actually ask for that. The only anomaly here is WSUS server has to be 2012 R2, not in the technical preview yet. And operations manager needs to be in technical preview as well, but the operations manager support both SQL Server 2012 and SQL Server 2014. And as you can see, the guest OS versions down there as well, fairly large set of support for Linux, as you can see. We actually added Debian as well as SUSE in the list of support OS matrix. On the networking side, the new capability we added in technical preview is something that's called guest CDN. I'll have a separate slide for this. But the rest, essentially, is, as I mentioned before, is a subset of the capability we're offering in R2. If you have been to Windows Server vNext session talking about networking investment in the future, in the next release, or storage section for that matter, you probably heard network controllers and other investment in the Windows Server vNext. We will have support for those. Coming up in the future, in the next release wave, but in technical preview, this set of capabilities is all we're recommending you to test. Now let's take a look at this guest CDN. What exactly is that feature? Are you guys familiar with CDN in general, consistent device name? Quick show of hands. Okay, not many people has experience with that. So. Let's step back to the physical world for a minute. If you have a physical server that has more than one NIC on the back of the machine, right? Two NICs or four NICs or whatever, how many NICs you have. There's literally no way for you to deterministically access one of those NIC cards. So you can't guarantee the NIC card on the back of the machine, this one, will be displayed or will be configured as if zero, if one, once the OS is installed, right? You guys have that experience, right? So because how operating system determine or name those network adapter cards is really based on SCSI bus, you know, which one responds back first, I'll give you if zero, if one, if two, so on and so forth. There's no guarantee. So if you were to write automation, if you were to actually create anything based on the name of the network adapter, good luck, right? There's really no guarantee on that. Now, there has been a technology being made available in the physical world. It's called consistent device name. What it is the manufacturer, the hardware vendor, can actually burn a name for each individual NIC in the BIOS. So when the OS boots up, it will be able to read and use that value as the name of the adapter. Some of the hardware vendors, if you go to Dell, I think actually most of the hardware major vendors supports that, HP, IBM. They actually put the device name on the NIC. So now it's very clear. If you go to the back of the physical machine, you see the name, and you will know that that same name will be used in the OS once the OS boots up. This is a very, very useful feature, right, in physical world. Now we made that same functionality available in the virtual world as well. So when you design, when you provision a virtual machine, even before the virtual machine is provisioned, you can define what name you want to call for the specific network adapter. And think about automations post-deployment. Right? Now you can write a script that's generic enough. You can apply to any virtual machine that you provision as long as they follow the same network configuration pattern. Right? In the past, it's impossible. You can't. Because you don't know which one will come up, show up by U0, which one show up by U1. Actually, I'll show you a demo. That's a video that I recorded back in the office. I'll show you how that actually looks like. But you know, the value for that is, I think, for people who have needs of creating virtual machines with more than one network adapters, and they want to do additional automation, or they just want to make sure that they know which network adapter goes to which network, for example. It's going to be very, very useful. So we talked about the compute, we talked about this networking, then now let's look at the storage side. The storage side, so there's also a brief mentioning in one of the Windows Server sessions about a share nothing scale out file server model in the vNext. Again, it's not available in technical preview yet. But when it becomes available, we'll also have corresponding capability to manage that on VMM side. Now, looking at the technical preview, this is, again, a set of functionalities or features that we'd like you to go try. It's largely a subset of what we're offering in R2. But all these capabilities will be targeted on the technical preview version of Windows Server. Just to reinforce our vision on the storage management side, right? So the future of software-defined storage to us from a VMM product perspective will continue to push for a unified storage management framework, which will all be based on SMAPI, Storage Management API. Right? This is industry standard protocol that we are driving with the entire industry. Our folks has been working with SNIA very tightly in various capacities. In regards, you're using fiber channel iSCSI SAN, NAS devices, or you prefer Windows file server to manage raw storage capacity, or building additional NAS storage underneath that. You know, we all, going forward, are all going to use SMAPI as the interface talking to the storage layer beneath us. So this is not only true for VMM as from a configuration and deployment perspective, also from a monitoring perspective, operations manager will also use that capability as well to make sure that we take advantage of the same standard. So let me switch. No, actually, this is an embedded video. So let's take a look at the demo for GetCDN. So before GetCDN was made available, if you look at on the right-hand side of the screen, we have a VM with two network adapter. There really is no way for you to tell which one is which. It just shows up as Ethernet and Ethernet 2. In this technical preview, even from the VMM side, the network adapter, we also name them just simply by using the same virtual machine's name. So it's not much useful. It's kind of confusing for you to figure out which network adapter is which. After CDN is enabled, after GetCDN is enabled, if you go to the advanced property of the network adapter, right, the Hyper-V network adapter name will become available. It's a new property. And then, as you can see showing in the demo, where you can specify that either with a completely custom string or with the VM network's name, so that it becomes, you know, a lot more meaningful to you as to figure out what that is. Now, the way to enable GetCDN is GetCDN only works with Gen 2 VM, Generation 2 VMs. So what you need to do is first create a VM template with Gen 2 VM as base. And obviously, to use GetCDN, you would have more than one network adapters, right? So once you create the templates, and you can create a virtual machine by using the templates. You know, just use generic information to create the VMs. And if you go to the hardware configuration section, what you notice is in the network adapter section, if you scroll all the way to the bottom, you'll see three options now, three new options. One is you can use the VM network's name as the CDN name, or you can use any custom string as the name for the CDN. So in this example, for the two network adapters, one we use the VM network's name as the adapter's name, and the other one we just, you know, typing any string as the custom name. Once you move on to the placement screen, what you'll notice is because it's Gen 2 VM only, we actually block on the R2 server. So this, once you have a CDN-enabled templates, those won't be able to apply to an R2 server. Only technical preview, the Windows Server vNext host, will be supported. On the API layer, for the commandlets, you'll notice that we also added two additional parameters in the commandlets. One is essentially the mode of the adapter's name. and in addition, if you chose to use a custom string, we'll also allow you to provide the name, the custom string, as the input to the commandlets. So that's how we are implementing that. Now, if the VM provisioning goes through, essentially shorten the video recording there, but you will see that in the advanced property of those adapters after the VM is provisioned, those values will be set with the value that you set during the VM deployment time. And those values not only available in VMM, you also see that in Hyper-V as well. So in Hyper-V commandlets or VMM commandlets, you should be able to retrieve those values. And in addition, if you switch to the Hyper-V UI, Hyper-V Manager UI, you'll also be able to see that we actually, in the Hyper-V UI, they actually use the CDN name as the label of the adapter. As you can see on the screen, that when it brings up, see the adapter's name actually changed to use those CDN labels. Okay, and we also automatically enable the selection of automatic device name. Now, one thing to note is for the getCDN capability, it's only available during the initial provisioning time. You cannot change that after the initial provisioning. If you were to change post-deployment, we also do not refresh the property back into VMM. You know, this is a similar concept as the physical CDN. You really only need it for the initial provisioning. Once it's provisioned, then we don't touch that. So just keep that in mind when you design any automations associated with that capability. All right, I think that's the getCDN demo. Now, so we talked about what we have changed in R2. We talked about what's coming in technical preview. Now let's spend some time on the best practices, and I'll throw in some tips as well on how to deploy and operate VMM in a large-scale data center. So when we think about large-scale data center, the first thing we have to consider is what are the needs, what are the requirements that our customer has in operating a large-scale data center. So number one thing is they all want the ability to pool those resources into pools, right? They all want the ability to dynamically allocate those resources to a certain user, right? And they all want to have the ability to automate operations in addition to some great UI, and the ability to monitor, the ability to collect usage, the ability to build customers, and the ability to allow users to self-service. So out of these requirements, here's what we recommend our customers to think about, you know, building your private cloud. This is also the same principle that we applied in CPS. So we recommend you to create a unit of compute storage network, a converged infrastructure, and system center being the management head, the management brain for your fabric. And you could build multiple stems of these converged systems, either because of redundancy, disaster recovery capabilities, or just because that you want to have units of manageable units. And also, we recommend you consider disaster recovery capabilities. I think this becomes increasingly important in recent, you know, natural disaster events. So with that in mind, the same principle applies to cloud platform system, CPS. We announced the availability of this in 20th of this month by our CEO and Scott, our VP, EVP. I think there's actually quite a few sessions on CPS already. But it's, what it is, essentially, it's a hardware plus software solution. It's a Microsoft private cloud solution powered by Dell server hardware. you can view that being an Azure consistent call-in-a-box solution. So it ships in 1 to 4 racks. If you were to order one, right, the thing will show up on your dock, will be one or many racks in your data center. And all you need to do once the rack arrives at your data center is to power them on, connect the network to your data center, and you're done. So the entire firmware, operating systems, software, configuration will be done for you before they shows up in your data center. And what we mean by what we mean by the private cloud is this whole stack of solution will be available to you. First of all, on the fabric layer, there will be a set of Dell PowerEdge servers serving as the compute units, and there will be Dell storage enclosure, essentially a set of 4 JBOT, and there also be Dell networking switches that's in that solution. and on top of that, we use Windows Server for Hyper-V for the compute cluster. We use scale-out file server. Essentially, we use storage space and expose the storage capacity in the form of SMB shares to all the compute clusters. And then we use System Center to manage all these resources. And on the top of that, we use Windows Azure Pack to expose no matter it's API interface or a portal to your user. So the capacity, by the way, the total capacity of such a system can host up to 8,000 VMs, and the total storage capacity, available storage capacity, is 1.1 terabyte. So let's take a look at what's inside of CPS. The reason I want to show CPS is we think it's very relevant. When we design CPS, we think it's very relevant how you should go back and think about you're designing your data center, private data center as well. No matter you buy CPS or not, the same design principle should be very much relevant to you. So the first rack of CPS solution, this is a logical view of the rack. You have, chunk of devices and servers reserved for the storage capacity. You have a bunch of compute nodes. And you have edge cluster nodes. And then you have a management cluster. Management cluster consists of six physical nodes. And inside the management cluster, it holds a set of workloads. VMM, obviously, is a very critical part of that. It's essentially the fabric controller. You also have operations manager for service, for monitoring. You have SMA for automation, DPM for backup and restore. You have SPF, essentially the layer between VMM and WAP. You also have WAP components that offers the tenant-facing API and UI. And then once you have the management cluster, you can start provisioning the edge cluster. What's inside the edge cluster is essentially a set of gateways that powers your Hyper-V network virtualization set of capabilities. It offers net services, forwarding services, and set-aside tunneling capabilities. And inside the compute cluster, obviously, that's a bunch of Hyper-V nodes, and clustered into a failover Hyper-V cluster, and that's where your tenant workload will be hosted. In the storage, on the storage side, it has a scale-out file server, 4-node scale-out file server, and managing a set of 4 JBODs. So once you have the first rack configured, the management head has been provisioned, then you can replicate the same kind of topology on the second rack, except you don't need to reprovision your management cluster. So all the nodes will be dedicated for compute capacity, and so on and so forth. You can just repeat that, right? And we think this is a fairly repeatable model in the sense that this gives you, again, the concept of a stamp. You can have 1 to 4 racks within a stamp, and each stamp is managed by a set of management components, and you can scale in and scale out as needed as your data center capacity grows. Now let's drill a little bit into the management cluster. What exactly is inside there? I mean, we showed a simple diagram earlier, but I want to show you exactly what's inside of CPS. So we'll, in a bit, we'll also look at exactly how do we provision the management cluster as well. Inside the management cluster, we'll have three nodes, AD, DNS, DCP services. And these services, the reason we have three nodes is we have the ability to sustain 2-node failure. And we believe high availability is an important part of managing your data center. So you want to make sure that you always have at least N plus one, meaning 1-node failure capability, right? You don't want to have a situation where your critical infrastructure fails and then the entire stem goes dead. And on the management workload side, so you have WDS, WSUS, you know, again, those components, VMM, OM, SMAs, and all these components. One thing to note is that all these things are, most of these things are provisioned in a failover mode, in a highly available mode, in a sense that both they have more than one instance to be able to sustain failures. And in addition, some of the workloads actually provision provides additional bandwidth capacity. The DPM, so the SQL cluster is also provisioned in the form of 4-node clusters. So you create a 4-node SQL cluster hosting all the services, hosting all the database services for all the management components. All right, so again, the idea of creating such a repeatable architecture is to make sure that we can form a dedicated management infrastructure such that, you know, this creates the necessary isolation as well as guarantee of resources for your management workloads. You use VMM and service templates to deploy additional infrastructure components. This allows you to reuse the templates that you created and also allows you to be able to rapidly scale out to additional rack as needed. And then you configure storage and network and edge units as you grow, as you add additional capacity into your data center. So you provision or deploy more templates for more stems. Now let's look at how exactly CPS is provisioned, right? Starting from the first rack, the first thing you do is you make sure that you have those foundational services provisioned, AD, DCP, DNS. If in your data center you already have those services, you know, you don't have to reprovision them. And then the next thing you do is you create the file server, the scale-out file server, because that's essentially the foundation, the shared storage you're going to need for your compute cluster. So once the scale-out file server is provisioned and configured, and then you can now go back to your management cluster to create the actual Hyper-V cluster for management purpose. And then you can create your SQL cluster and HAVMM on top of the management cluster by using the shared storage that's exposed through the scale-out file server. Now, once VMM is provisioned, now you will have the ability to apply service templates to create SMA. SMA is the automation foundation. So once SMA is provisioned, you have the ability to use runbooks, automation runbooks, to provision additional workloads by using templates, by using additional PowerShell script to configure those components. So once those components are provisioned, now you can move on to provision the edge cluster. Again, edge cluster essentially is a Hyper-V cluster by using VMM to bare metal provisioning the nodes and adding them into cluster, and then use service template to provision the additional gateway clusters inside the edge cluster. And then you can provision additional compute cluster, Hyper-V cluster, by using VMM as well. Right. One thing to note is the Windows Azure Pack public tier is actually created inside the compute cluster because we want the ability to dynamically scale out your web tier as needed. And then the last couple steps is to make sure your OM is configured. All the agents are provisioned to all the nodes that needs to be managed so that you can also push down the MPs that's built for your environment. In case of CPS, there's a whole set of MPs that we created specifically for CPS. But in your environment, if you have any vendor, hardware vendor specific MP, you should make sure that provision those MPs into your environment so that your environment can be monitored for the resource you have. similar approach needs to be applied for DPM as well, right? So DPM agent needs to be pushed down to all the Hyper-V hosts so all the VMs can be backed up and restored. One thing to know in CPS, we created a dedicated backup pool inside our storage scale unit that's dedicated for backup. And we also use dedupe in the backup pool to make sure we use the most efficient usage of the storage space we have down there. And once the first rack is complete, now you can just apply, you know, again, the service template you've created for first rack, you know, just repeat that for the second rack and third rack and fourth rack. So that's essentially what CPS is under the context of, you know, how does deployment works for your private, how your private cloud deployment should look like. And let me just switch to a live environment down at the expo floor. If you have chance to, you have not got a chance to look at the rack, I highly recommend you to log on to the to go visit the rack. Switch to my demo machine. So this is the VMM console that's running on the rack in the expo floor, right? Let's first look at the on the infrastructure node. Let's first take a look at the clusters we have. As you see, that we have totally 32 compute nodes, and out of the 32, six of them are dedicated for the management cluster, and two nodes are dedicated for edge cluster, and there's 24 nodes dedicated for compute, for the first rack. For this, from the second to the fourth rack, you'll notice that it will be 30 nodes dedicated for the compute cluster because we no longer have needs for a management cluster. On the storage side, if you look at the file server, essentially there is one scale-out file server hosting about 34 file shares. Again, the file servers are managing those four JBODs in the form of three storage pools, and then we create virtual disks on top of the storage pool. And then the file server will then create SMB share on top of the virtual disks and make the shares available to the compute cluster to consume. And in the network section, and you'll notice that we have of nine IP pools and logical networks. And in a minute, I'll actually show you how we design the network topology inside of CPS. You know, again, we recommend isolations between your management networks, from your tenant networks, from your service network, from obviously your public internet. And inside of the management cluster, inside management cluster, as we talked earlier, there's a set of services that's been provisioned. As you notice that this is actually a service template view, the service view inside the VM's domain. So we provision all these workloads in the form of service template, right? WDS, SQL Server. SQL Server is actually using a shared VHDX. It's a four node virtual machines and shared with a shared VHDX. SPF, Windows Azure Pack, OIM, WSUS, all these workloads are provisioned through our service template. So that's the VMM console. Let me switch over to the tenant service admin portal as well. It's going to take a minute for this portal to refresh. But this one is the service admin portal that comes with Windows Azure Pack. So when you order CPS, all these things comes in pre-configured for you, right? As you can see on the left-hand side, a set of capabilities, a set of services that's available in this Windows Azure Pack is VM Cloud, website services, SQL and MySQL service, service bus clouds. All these services comes in as part of Windows Azure Pack. We also have SMA. Automation is also comes in with the integration with the Windows Azure Pack. Now, if I switch to attendant view, this is one of the tenants I'm logged in as user 01 on this tenant cloud. As you can see, I have totally 80 virtual machines, 9 website services, and 3 SQL and 3 MySQL database services subscribed right now. So this interface are very much similar to what you would see on Windows Azure. And all these comes to you from the Microsoft Private Cloud solution stack with the Windows Server on the bottom, System Center in the middle, and the Windows Azure on the top. Okay, so also I want to show you the OM console. This is the dashboard that we created for CPS as well. As you can see, we separate them into different groups. There's compute cluster, health, storage cluster health, network cluster health, and so on and so forth. These are created specifically for CPS. And we created a whole set of management packs from the hardware all the way to Windows Azure Pack to make sure that we have a unified health view into the system. All right, so that's the demo for CPS. Again, if you have not seen CPS yet, please go to the demo floor, to the expo floor to take a look at it. So we talked about the deployment methods or best practice for CPS, for VMM and under the context of CPS. Now let's look at the storage best practice. This is similar to the topology diagram that I showed with what do we manage from a storage point of view. There's obviously SMAPI layer that I omit from this slide. But essentially, from a VMM perspective, we manage all kinds of storage solutions. It doesn't matter if it's a SAN, it's a NAS, or it's through Windows Server. But from Microsoft point of view, from VMM point of view, we actually recommend to use scale-out file server. You may ask why. Because A, we believe the future of storage solution is going to be software-defined, a software-driven storage solution. Microsoft is investing heavily in our file server management story. As a matter of fact, if you have not, maybe if you have, but if you've gone to the storage section, you will see that some of the performance through Microsoft's file server, scale-out file server, is quite stunning of how much performance we can get in some of the workload areas that we can compete head-to-head with some of the SAN, fiber channel SAN storage solution as well, from an IO point of view, from latency point of view. So in fact, if you see in CPS, the storage solution that we have is based on a bunch of JBOD at the bottom, and then with SAS connector, connect directly to the scale-out file server, and then we expose that through SMB. Right? So we believe that this will be the future-proof model going forward. So if you already have existing SAN solution, NAS solution, great, continue to use that. Right? VMM supports them. But if you were to build new capacities in your storage section, we highly, highly recommend you to consider this option. A, it's very cost, price performance competitive. B, it is the future of storage management, right? Everyone is going down to the path of software-defined storage, and that is the software-defined storage from Microsoft point of view. Now, on the network side that as I mentioned before, I'm going to show what kind of topology we recommend. Starting from the internet, it probably goes through a firewall before it hits your corporation. And maybe for some of your business, you never ever actually have any connectivity to the public internet. That's fine. But in your corpnet, that's where most of your IT admins or your IT managers will be lived on. And then there's probably either ACL or there's maybe additional firewalls between your corporate network and your data center network. So the yellow management network, that's essentially your data center network. And that's where all your management workloads should live, right? Your VMM, your operations manager, your SQL database. If you want to, some people also put SQL in a different subnet as well. But from kind of a logical point of view, they should all live in this management network domain. Notice that for Windows Azure Pack, it typically has two legs. One leg's on the management network, and the other one needs to be, because the portal and the API needs to be exposed to the network domain that your user, end user, needs to consume. If you are completely intranet environment, then the other leg probably could go to your corpnet. But if you're a hoster or a public service provider, then you probably expose WAP, Windows Azure Pack, to the public internet. Now, on the tenant side, all the guests lives inside your, you know, your private cloud should go through. We, again, recommend use Hyper-V network virtualization, should expose their, should access external through the MVGRE gateway that's part of, you know, our solution. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we have measured in CPS is that we are able to achieve up to 18 gigabytes of traffic between the VMs inside of the environment, which is a stunning number. And even going through from within the stamp, within the cloud, going out through the VPN tunnel to another endpoint somewhere out there, the throughput can achieve 1.8 gigabytes. Again, it's very, very good numbers compared with, you know, the traditional hardware-based network model. So again, we recommend you to consider using the software-defined network solutions from Microsoft, specifically, Hyper-V network virtualization technology. And a Hyper-V host lives on the bottom, and they should also belong to part of the management network because that's where VMM and other management components needs to access and control those Hyper-V hosts. And for live migration, clustering, heartbeat network, and storage network, they could be on their own separate networks. So that's kind of the topology for network. And this is also the best practice that we recommend. So we talked about compute, storage, and network, and deployment. Now let's look at the scale topology. In CPS, we have one Windows Azure Pack portal, we have one SPF instance, we have one VMM instance. But in our lab, we actually tested the topology where you have one Azure portal, one Azure Pack, Windows Azure Pack, one SPF, that you can connect up to five VMM instances. Right. So it's, again, depends on your topology. We support up to five VMM instances connecting to one SPF. With any standalone VMM instance, we support up to 25,000 VMs per VMM server. But if you were to put VMM behind SPF, and if you were to use five instances of VMM, then each instance of VMM would be limited to only 5,000 VMs. So essentially, the upper bound for SPF is also 25,000 VMs. So keep that in mind when you design your architecture within your data center. So again, a quick recap. VMM support up to 25,000 VMs, up to 1,000 user roles. Actually, we also support up to 1,000 hosts, number of hosts. Now, from SPF point of view, the maximum is also 25,000 VMs, okay? Support up to five VMM instances. Now, on the sizing suggestion, so what kind of configuration you should have on your VMM server, SQL database server, and other things. So here is kind of our recommendation. If you have less than 4,000 VMs in your environment, we recommend that you start with 8-core and 8-gig RAM and memory for your VMM server. We always recommend you to use HAVMM. There's another slide talk about that. But if you, and also the same configuration for your SQL cluster, SPF server, as well as WAP WAP role. The WAP role is actually are less compute and CPU intense, so they have less requirement on the hardware configuration. And we also recommend that you use load balancers for your SPF and your WAP roles. As soon as you go beyond 4,000 VMs, we recommend you to double the configuration. So some more tips on the deployment or configuration of your environment. You know, again, always set up a HAVMM for highly availability. In fact, what we do in CPS is first we create HAVMs for VMM server, right? And then you provision HAVMM on those HAVMs. What does it do is it provides you two levels of highly availability. The first level is hardware failure. In case any Hyper-V node goes bad, you have the build, you have, you know, a live migration or the cluster service to guarantee you from the hardware failure. The second layer of availability is in case any service goes down inside the VM, because there are HA inside the guest as well, so that guarantees the service crash or service any service interruption that you may have experienced. So always set up HA VMM for high level availability. Always use remote SQL. If you are using, you know, kind of kicking the box or sandbox environment test, it's fine to install everything in a single machine, but do not do that in production, right? Because what we have found is both SQL and VMM are fairly CPU intense, particularly in a large environment. So you will have a situation, if you install them on the same box, doesn't matter physical or virtual, you'll have a situation where they compete on CPU resources, which is not good. So always use remote SQL. For Hyper-V host, you know, we obviously always recommend you to use the latest version, but if you were to use earlier version of Windows Server, please make sure you install Windows Management Framework. I believe 4.0 was released. So what it essentially will give you is the latest version of PowerShell, latest version of Windows WinRM, and those capabilities are critical for VMM to take advantage of the latest capability. For example, eventing, right? There has been not only new capabilities, but also bug fixes as well in those latest version of Windows Management Framework. So please always make sure you update them to latest Windows Management Framework. Obviously, we prefer you to stay with the most current Windows Server OS, 2012 R2, if possible. SPF is CPU intense, so be sure that you actually scale out SPF based on your SLAs, based on how what's the response time you want for your SPF. One thing that we monitor inside our own lab is we look at what's the request per minute throughputs at SPF server site, so that you can determine whether or not you need to scale out provision additional SPF servers. The return first for placement is very good for large environment. If you have a small environment, let's say 4 host or 10 host, probably don't need that. But if you have anything beyond, let's say 20 host, I would recommend you should consider that if speed is important. What essentially you're trading off by using return first is the speed of placement versus the completeness of searching for the best suitable host, right? Because return first is essentially saying, hey, don't need to, you know, search through the entire population of the host. Just give me one that's suitable. I don't need to know the optimal one. But if you don't use that, we'll search all the hosts to find the most optimal one for you, right? So you get the full star rating back. Multiple library for load balancing. Actually, one of the attendees asked this question. We do have the ability. I don't know if this is a hidden feature. Probably we didn't do enough education on this. There is a capability that you can create multiple library servers, and you can actually tag them for a specific host group. Let's see, if you have a VMM server that you arrange the host groups based on site, New York, Paris, Barcelona, London sites, and they belong to different host groups, you can actually create a library server and tag that in a way to say this library server will be, you know, serving this host group. When you do that, it will actually help when you provision a VM that falls under that host group. We will look at that library server first. You know, this will save some copying over the WAN or long distance. And Windows Azure Pack has a web operation timeout setting. This, again, is kind of one of the hidden settings. By default, it's 100 seconds. If, for example, in your environment, again, speed is not the critical thing, or if you will create lots and lots of large VMs, maybe you want to tune the setting a little bit so that you don't let your customer experience timeouts. Although, you know, the web part will time out, but the VM actually will be created eventually. But it, you know, it's again something that you can consider to tune if in your environment you always create large VMs and or your system resource on the website is not you know powerful enough to get back to the user fast enough. So these are the things that that we recommend as the best practice. With that, actually, this leads to the last slide of my session. Again, three things real quick. Microsoft Private Cloud is Windows Server, System Center, and Windows Azure Pack on top, right? This is our private cloud solution. It captures all the learnings experience we have from running large-scaled online servers that bring down to your data center. We are continuing investing in the fabric management experience to make sure that your management experience is easier, more integrated, more secure, and more cost efficient. Lastly, but not leastly, if you haven't seen CPS yet, go to Explore Floor and take a look at yourself. It's a beautiful thing. All right, thank you so much. And I'll be here to answer any additional questions. I'm sorry this session ran fairly long, but I'll be here and feel free to come up with any specific questions. Thank you.